恭喜发财。
Hello and welcome to the Leap of Faith and 新年快乐 Happy New Year to our Chinese listeners 恭喜发财 Tuesday was the start of the new year, the year of the pig. Later we'll hear from some members of the Chinese community in Ireland as they celebrated this week. Also, it's not only author Dan Brown who can translate religious codes in the Da Vinci Code, but we'll also hear from a divinity student who's cracked a religious cipher that has baffled academics for years.But first, this week saw an historic visit by Pope Francis to the United Arab Emirates. The visit represented a first in 1,400 years of Islamic history, and its significance has been felt in the Middle East. Nearly every Arabic language paper in the region featured the story on its front page, including Saudi Arabia's most influential paper that featured the headline, Saudi Arabia may feature in a future papal visit.To discuss this in more detail, we're joined from Abu Dhabi by Kilrush Warren, Father Michael O'Sullivan. Michael, welcome to the Leap of Faith. How does a clergyman become coordinator of this historic visit?
Clergyman becomes involved because I'm a white father and I have been working in the Arab world for the last 30 years from Algeria to Sudan to the Holy Land. And I was here in the United Arab Emirates as a financial administrator about 4 years ago, and Bishop Paul Hinder asked me to come back and organize a visit here. So we got about 2 months' notice, and so it's been all go for the last two months, and it's been a real honor and privilege to organize this first papal visit to the Arabian Peninsula.
And can you put this visit in context? Because it is, you know, it's often a cliche, but this is historic.
It's historic, I would say yes and no. It's historic, of course, that it's the first visit to the Arabian Peninsula, which is the cradle of Islam. And as you mentioned in your introduction, Saudi Arabia is just next door and doesn't have any churches, doesn't allow any freedom of worship. But it's not historic in that the Catholic Church has been dialoguing with Muslims right back to the Vatican, to Vatican II rather, when with the document Nostra Aetate, which signaled a new phase in Catholic or Christian Muslim relations. So there has been 50 years of dialogue with Muslims in different forums and in different countries. But you're right, this is historic in that it's the first visit of a Roman pontiff to the Arabian Peninsula. And in fact, Tuesday's Mass was really something very, very public. Up to now, our prayers have been reduced or confined to the church compounds, but Tuesday's Mass was a really public event in which up to 150,000 people were present. It was really something very, very splendid.
Now, the makeup of the congregation for this event, too, was particularly, I suppose, focused mostly on expatriates?
Yeah, all expatriates, of course. There are no local Christians, but we have a lot of Arab Christians from the Middle East, from Lebanon, from Palestine, from Syria. But most of the community is made up of Indians and Filipinos. But in fact, our church community is made up of probably about 8 or 19 nationalities. I was very much involved in the choir, and we worked very hard for the last 2 months. And even in the choir, I think there were 22 nationalities singing in the choir.
To what extent was the Pope in position to discuss human rights in the Middle East?
Well, perhaps the question of human rights was discussed in the private meetings. It wasn't really discussed in the public forum. The main reason for him coming was to attend a meeting organized by the UAE on human fraternity, in which about 700 delegates, Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Sikhs, Jews were present. And there he gave a very moving speech on the whole question of not only freedom of worship, but educating people towards tolerance. And so the question really of human rights wasn't really on the agenda per se, but it was on the agenda, if you like, I'm sure, in the private meetings. And just before leaving from Rome, on the Sunday Angelus, he did speak of the problem of the current situation in Yemen, which we know is absolutely catastrophic.
Can you describe the level of welcome he received from in the UAE?
Oh, the welcome was absolutely tremendous. First of all, the welcome from the UAE authorities, in that they really organized everything for us. And we were really their guests. And those from the presidential palace, right from the very beginning, said, he is our guest and you are our guest. So everything was organized by the government, and everything, dare I say, was funded by the government, which in the Irish context is, in the context here, is very much appreciated. And when you see what the debate that has been happening in Ireland over the last 6 months with regard to the papal visit, I think this is rather significant. In a totally Muslim country, this visit was a huge success. We distributed approximately 140,000 tickets, and if we had had a bigger place, we would have probably had double that number of people coming. People started coming at entering into the stadium at 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and the Mass was at 10:30. In other words, 10 or 12 hours before the beginning of Mass.
Father Michael, to what extent was the good news story of interfaith relations overshadowed by revelations about the abuse of nuns by priests and bishops, which the Pope discussed on the flight home, I believe, to Rome?
To be honest, I don't know. I'm certain that issue was not mentioned here, and I haven't been able to be following up the news in the last 24 hours since the Holy Father left. So I can't really comment on that. No, it wasn't mentioned here at all.
Now that the visit has been completed, what do you believe will happen next?
Well, the encounter, the meeting between the Grand Imam of the Al-Azhar Mosque in Rome is probably the second or third meeting that has happened. And here we have two big institutions, the Catholic Church and the Al-Azhar Mosque in Rome, dialoguing with regard to education and educating people towards tolerance. And I think that is very significant, and particularly for the Muslim world. And in that light, the UAE sees itself as a beacon of not only tolerance, but promoting inter-religious dialogue, promoting education, and promoting tolerance in the Arab world. And from that point of view, I think a lot has been achieved by this meeting, and I'm sure a lot will be achieved as well in the future.
Father Michael O'Sullivan in Dubai, thank you. Well, next this evening, our producer, Sheila O'Callaghan, visited the home of Wei Yang, his wife, Anna Wei Wei Gon, and their 12-year-old son, Lucas. Wei is Chinese director at UCD's Confucius Institute, and they've been living in Dublin for the past year. Sheila joined them as they celebrated with their family and friends on the eve of Chinese New Year.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Welcome,
Sheila.
Thank you so much for inviting me into your home.
Come in, please.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
This is my wife.
Hi, I'm Wei Wei.
Hello, my name is Lucas.
This is my mother and my father. They just come over to celebrate Chinese New Year with us. They live in China.
And is this your first time in Ireland?
这是不是你第一次来爱尔兰?
第一次。第一次。
Yeah, that's she's first time to Ireland. She really like it. Mm-hmm. This is my grandfather.
Hello, very pleased to meet you. Are you enjoying your stay?
你觉得你在爱尔兰的感觉怎么样?
非常好,舒服。 那现在主要是空气好,气候好,确实是,不错。
My grandfather really liked the fresh air of the island.
These two people is my colleague, Professor Li Mingwang and Professor Lan Li, and they both work in UCD.
Okay, welcome to our party. This is our New Year's Eve party. As Chinese New Year's Eve, normally it's a family reunion and the gathering. Not really include even friends or colleagues. But since we are here in Ireland, we change a little bit. You know, that's a kind of an extended party which you can include your close friend or colleague to celebrate together.
This is a very busy kitchen here this evening. You've got some lovely aromas swirling through the air and lots of pots and pans and dishes and numerous ladles. So would you like to tell me a little bit about what you're cooking at the moment? Who's the chief cook here then this evening?
I think probably grandmom. Yeah. She has prepared everything for the family.
This is Chinese traditional Christmas. This is made a Song Lu Qi Tang.
And this is the Chinese culture New Year, and this is the chicken soup with truffle.
Truffles.
Yeah.
It smells delicious. I'm sure it must taste delicious. So tell me about some of the other dishes that you have. You have such a variety, so many different colors and textures.
Yeah, fish, pork, and vegetables, shrimp, something like that.
This fish is traditional fried fish, and this is traditional Irish salmon. Yeah, salmon.
Of course, the main course is a jiaozi.
It's dumpling in English. It's the Chinese culture food. It's really, really important in the culture, Chinese New Year. And it's really, really delicious. And we got two type of food inside the dumpling. One is the pig meat with some Chinese cabbage. And the other one is shrimp and eggs, some egg.
So the foods here are very carefully selected for this special occasion.
Yes. Especially, we should have fish. This is very important for this evening.
The fish means you can get the things you want and you get more than things you want. And the chicken means luck. You can get luck in the new year.
So we're leaving behind the year of one particular animal and we're about to embark on a whole other new year. Tell me about that.
The year of dog is like the last year, and we just lived that year for this year. And the year of dog have some meaning too. The dogs means loyalty and friendly. It means we can get friends and more like conversation with the other guys you don't know in the last year. This year is the year of pig, and pig means what? Pig means richness. And
does that mean just financial richness, or does that mean richness in other ways too?
And not just the richness in the money or something else. You have the richness of happiness, you have richness of luckness, you can have other things you can have too. And I wish the friend of Ireland and this country got a fruitful new year.
And Lali, could you explain to me why this selection of animals and what the symbolism is?
Actually, because in the traditional China, and we have very complicated system to calculate years, and not easy for people to remember, you know, which year. So that's why, you know, we just pick up, you know, the very popular 12 animals to, you know, help people to remember which year it is.
This is a huge celebration for you all. Mm-hmm. Is there a more spiritual aspect to it?
Yes, actually, traditionally, we celebrate Chinese New Year with a very strong religious beliefs, like, you know, ancestor worship. We believe, actually, we can get protection from ancestor if we just, you know, show our worship to them, show respect and show, actually, the sacrifice and offerings to them.
Lei Ming, ancestor worship, that's really very much an ancient tradition, isn't it, for Chinese people?
That's right. That's for probably thousands of years. People living in rural China in a traditional agricultural society. So the people would like to celebrate New Year, and at the same time, they also show their respect, worship to the ancestors, because they believe when they worship the ancestors, then ancestors would protect them in the New Year. Especially to drive evil spirit away, even to have another good year of harvest. So that really depends on how you worship and respect your ancestor. Yeah.
So as well as a time of looking ahead, it's a time to reconnect with the past.
Yes, actually, that's a very important turning point today. Yeah, we just, we review the past year, and we just, you know, welcome the new year ahead.
So here in Ireland, when it's New Year's Eve, we sing Auld Lang Syne and we wish each other a happy new year. What do you do in China?
新年快乐! Happy New Year!
So we have music, we sing, and Lucas, you're also going to be performing some music here this evening.
Yes, I will play the Junkfield piece, and it's cultural Irish music. And may the music bring the family happiness and luckiness.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me into your home this evening. It was a real privilege to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're very welcome to have dinner with us.
Thank you. It'd be hard to resist.
Sheila O'Callaghan visiting the home of Wei Jiang and his wife Anna Wei Wei Gan and their son Lucas in Dublin as they celebrated with their family and friends on the eve of the Chinese New Year. And you'll find more information about events taking place this weekend to mark the Chinese New Year on our website rte.ie/radio1/The Leap of Faith. Next this evening, the subject of cryptography is of obvious interest to many as it includes intrigue, secrecy, the Enigma cipher, and the possibility of some great revelations. The success of Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, selling over 80 million copies, might be proof of that. A divinity student from the University of St Andrews in Scotland has cracked a religious code that has baffled academics for generations. And I'm joined now from St Andrews by that student, Johnny Woods, and the head of the School of Divinity at the University of St Andrews, Dr. Steve Holmes. Gentlemen, welcome to The Leap of Faith. Steve, tell us the background to the story and how this assignment came about in the first place.
So I have known about Andrew Fuller, who's an 18th century figure, very significant for 20 years, 30 years that I've been working. And a couple of years ago, someone contacted me saying there was a new major critical edition of his works coming out in lots of volumes, and would I edit the sermons? So I said yes, and knew that there were 150 or so printed during his life or quite quickly afterwards. And also knew from books about him that other people had written that there was a bunch of manuscript shorthand notes, sermon notes, in an archive in Bristol Baptist College that no one could read. And I thought, well, I really ought to go down and have a look. I didn't expect to be able to read them, but it seemed the sort of thing you ought to do for completeness. So I booked a day in Bristol. They were very kind. They were rebuilding, but kind of cleared a space for me and found the stuff. And spent a day just looking over this stuff, and fairly quickly thought, no, I really can't read these. But there were longhand headings to every one, which I could read. So I went through the collection one by one, just making a note of the sorts of things he was preaching on and so on. And I thought that was all I was going to get out of it. And then really quite late in the day, right at the back of the book, came across a page that was headed Confession of Faith, October 7th, 1783, which was a date I recognized as his induction into a new church. And thought, I know that we've got a confession of faith that he gave during that service, printed in one of the early biographies. I wonder if we could put these documents next to each other and make some headway in terms of getting into this shorthand.
Now, we're not talking about bad handwriting here. Are we talking about an actual code?
We're talking about a private shorthand system. So he writes as modern shorthand does, generally writes the consonants only, and each one is represented by a simple line, and then he runs the lines together to make a word. So, yes, a code.
Steve, give us a little bit more insight into this man as a preacher and as a theologian.
So Andrew Fuller is a Baptist leader, the end of the 18th century into the 19th. He dies 1815. And really, he's historically significant for two reasons. He writes the book, and it really is the book that changes the course of the Baptist denomination. During the 18th century in Britain, there's a series of religious revivals. Methodism comes out of it, the evangelical revival. And this was all passing the Baptists by completely, and they were kind of dwindling into insignificance. And Fuller writes the text that gets them into this, gets them involved in this. So that's the first thing that he's important for. The second is with a chap called William Carey, a close friend of his. He founds the Baptist Mission Society, which is the very first of the modern Protestant mission movements. And so the whole history of Victorian mission, with all the amazing stories of heroism and all the troubling stories of colonialism and cruelty, he's right at the beginning of all that. Carey goes as a missionary to Serampore in India. Fuller stays home and creates the organization that funnels money and asks for prayer support and gets people interested and gets other people wanting to join the mission as well. So he kind of starts the organization of modern Christian mission, which, you know, is a really significant story, and he's there at the beginning of it.
Now, as head of school, you get to pull rank, and rather than setting about this decoding yourself, you pass it on as an assignment.
Well, something like that. We have a wonderful scheme in the university where there's money that we can apply for that allows us to pay undergraduate students to help us in our research, which is a great thing, actually, because it kind of emphasises that this is a community of scholarship. We're all interested and doing stuff. As you say, it gets work off our desks and it gives our impoverished undergraduates some money. So I put in for some money out of this and was successful and asked around as to who might be interested in doing it, and that's how Johnny came into the story.
So Johnny, you're from Coleraine in Northern Ireland, and you found yourself with this particular assignment. Where did you start?
Well, thankfully Steve didn't leave me completely on my own. He gave me the Confession of Faith, both shorthand and typed up. So he gave me the instructions of where to begin, but after that it was just see if this was doable. And thankfully it was.
Now, I have a vision in my head of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and exploring something really mysterious. What was the Rosetta Stone in this? How did you actually crack the code? And do you remember the moment it happened?
Well, as Steve said, the Confession of Faith was really the key to cracking the code, as it were. It allowed us to see how Fuller put these little marks and signs together to form words, and as he left out many letters, it helped us to understand his logic of how words came together.
Were you prying into somebody's private writing, or do you believe that he would have any problem with you reading his work so many years later?
I think he would be fine with it. As these were sermons that he preached, they were for the public, and they were all collected by his son and preserved, so I don't think he would have any problem with us recovering these.
What did you get once you started reading the cracked code? Was there a moment for you of insight into the person himself, the man himself?
Well, I think Steve definitely had a more eye-opening moment than I did, because I spent a number of months slugging through each word and each sentence, trying to understand how it worked, that whenever I was able to present it to Steve, I think he got more of a moment of astonishment than I did.
Have you now learnt a new code? Have you used the code since yourself?
I actually once when I was in class, I don't know if I should say this, but when I was in class and I got a little bit bored, I thought it would be a nice experiment to see if I could actually write in the code and see if I could write as Fuller did. And it occupied a good bit of time, and I wasn't so bored in the class anymore.
Well, there's an insight that you're sharing with your head of school at the same time. I am curious, though, about one thing, is whether you are good at doing this coding stuff. In other words, is this a hobby for you? Was this something that appealed to you? Why did you decide, okay, I'll do this?
Well, I've always enjoyed solving problems and similar things, but I had no previous experience in decoding. So it wasn't a hobby before, but it's definitely become one now. Definitely working with Andrew Fuller's shorthand has been really challenging, but also really fulfilling for me as well.
Back to you, Steve, for a moment. Then we heard Johnny mention that he believes you got an insight from reading the documents for the first time. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I mean, it was a real kind of moment of excitement, astonishment. As I said earlier, I've been working on this guy 20, 30 years, and Johnny sends me an email with a Word document attached, and I open it and start reading and think, these are new words that no one's read before since he preached them back in 1783. The first two sermons I asked Johnny to look at were sermons he preached on leaving his boyhood church where he'd grown up and where he'd then become the minister of, and a little village in rural Cambridgeshire. And the sense of the love and care he had for those people and the wrench it was to go was very, very powerful. You got an insight into his character that was something very special.
It may not be an academic phrase, but I'm curious as to whether there was a bit of a tingle, the fact that you're reading something that no one else has actually seen or heard spoken out loud since 1783.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, definitely a tingle. There's the line we sometimes use is, I feel like I'm a proper scholar today. And that was one of those days, yeah.
Stephen, obvious question is, what's next to Decode?
Well, we have about 700 pages of Fuller shorthand, and we've done about maybe 12 of them. So there's a fair amount still to go. We've got three collections from the beginning of his life, the middle and the end. So it's going to be kind of interesting to put them next to each other and compare what's going on. So we'll get there, and then, you know, in 5 years' time, maybe there'll be something else.
This could be Johnny's PhD before he's finished.
It could well be.
Johnny Woods and Dr. Steve Holmes, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
Finally this evening, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland has this week selected the Reverend William Henry, minister of Mays Presbyterian Church in County Antrim, to be its next moderator. Its youngest in living memory. Mr. Henry will be officially nominated to this year's General Assembly in Belfast on Monday, June 3rd, when he'll succeed the current moderator, the Right Reverend Dr. Charles McMullen. And this week, if you're a fan of gospel and country music, you might like to know that the service this Sunday morning on RTE Radio 1 Extra and on Longwave 252 is a country gospel service, and you can hear that at 11 o'clock. From producer Sheila O'Callaghan and myself, Michael Cullen, good night.